Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wabo's most fetching work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse, and as you can tell from that notable absence, I'm coming to you alone. Oh, tragic. But thematically working out, considering the chapters that we're talking about today, we'll be talking about playing a part 15.9 and playing a part 15.10, which are two chapters where you really feel the loneliness from Lucy feeling, you know, isolated from her fellow Kenneteers. And similarly, I feel the isolation from my fellow podcast co-host, Elliot, who is in the midst of moving house at the moment. So it's just me today. But while I may be the only recorded voice you hear this week, I'm not fully alone because I have all of you that are listening live in the Discord, in the live thread. So as we go along, I'm going to be prompting some questions and I might be pulling some thoughts out from people in chat if people leave their thoughts in chat and want to, you know, comment on some of the things that, we're talking about. Feel free to do so. If you are not aware, we do live recordings and you can find those by going to doofmedia.com/discord and joining the Discord. And we do them every, you know, every Sunday morning for us here in Australia. To touch on just the schedule a little bit more in case you missed it last week, over the next month or so of, you know, Christmas and New Year's, schedules are going to be a little bit wonky, so we might have some solo episodes. I think next week is another solo episode with just me, so look forward to that. Then we've got a regular episode with myself and Elliot again, and then Elliot's doing a few solo episodes and etc. So you can jump into Discord if you want to hear the, you know, get the full stream schedule breakdown and all that stuff. But enough housekeeping, huh? Let's get into the actual chapter. One of the chapters. We're talking about playing a part 15.9. So we pick up immediately where we left off here. Lucy and the family man are talking and it is immediately rocky, right? It's very tense. But obviously we don't want them to have a positive relationship. So it's good that it's tense, I guess. I don't know. I was, the family man is a very interesting character here. One, I like that we have just a completely unambiguously bad character, which doesn't always happen in Wabo stories, but it is fun when it does. We get this one line that I really loved where, Lucy says like, "Oh, your people aren't happy." And the family man touches one of the pregnant women near him and she just goes, "I'm happy. I'm very happy," which is just, brilliant. A brilliant bit of signalling to us how much of a villain he is. But yeah, like, I love having the family man as a villain, and he's such like a, I don't know, he's so like smarmy and he's so easy to hate, which is just delightful. Lucy does very well exchanging barbs with him, I think. She leads in with this point of like, "If you think I'm incompetent, you should want to deal with me even more." And that immediately just cuts through all of his bullshit, which is very satisfying. And there's that moment where Rook compliments Lucy as well, saying, you know, "Conquerors her age have taken whole tracts of the human world." And that's, again, just very, a very nice moment. There's a lot of really nice moments here, especially with Rook and Lucy. The Rook and Lucy dynamic, this chapter specifically, is very strong. Yeah, it's really a nice compliment from Rook. And it's, you know, obviously Rook has kind of stepped into a mentor role for Lucy, but is interestingly a lot less warm than like John or some of her father figures have been, which I think is an interesting dynamic for Rook and one that Lucy probably needs. A mentor that is like, you know, compassionate and caring, but not especially warm. I don't know, given that a lot of Lucy's previous mentor relationships have ended tragically, it's maybe good to have one that's, I don't know the right word for it. Not like professional, but like distanced, but still supportive. You know what I mean? I feel like that's just something that would be helpful to Lucy. Yeah, it's a good point, but I'm easily impressed. Like, Rook is maybe a little bit more distant as she doesn't want to enter the in air quotes, role of Lucy's mentor, because that's, you know, that's a real defense of the dark arts level position in that it's 100% cursed. So Rook is probably doing the right thing by not leaning too much into it. I want to touch on one more thing about the family man in this conversation, though, which is he's so insistent on parity between the Kennet Council and the Undercity. And this is something that is going to run as a thread through this and the conversation with the Bitter Witch in a moment. But like, yeah, it's a valid point, and I hate to say it, it's, you know, it's that Onion article of somebody you hate actually made a good point, but the Kennet Council are, I think, pretty antsy about letting the Undercity actually govern itself, right? And I think that's a problem that needs to be addressed, is they want the Undercity to feel like it's a, you know, like it's a part of the group, like it's a real legitimate part that can exist on its own and have stability. But obviously they're not yet at the point where they can let it govern itself. And I don't know. I don't know if they will ever get to the point where they can fully feel like they can let it govern itself without somebody like Verona being a bit of an enforcer and making sure the rules are being adhered to. Which is, like, obviously you get the reasons for that, but it's inherently problematic, right? Like, it's inherently meaning that there's going to be a power dynamic that is one-sided, at least slightly. Wabo raises the question of, does the family man really want parody, or is he just using that to achieve his own ends? And almost certainly that is a part of what he's doing. But I do think the point of parody between Kennet and the Undercity is one that the Kennet Council really doesn't have a good approach that they're comfortable with yet, right? I definitely think the family man is just using points that he thinks will get through to Lucy, which is obviously a good strategy for him, and he's being a shitheel about it. But, you know, this is something that I think the Kennet Council hasn't come to terms with yet. Like, they're not comfortable letting the Undercity govern itself yet. Fine, while the family man has some level of power, sure, but I don't know. Will they ever get to that point? Will there ever be a point where they say, okay, you know, somebody like the Bitter Street Witch and the school vice principal, for example, we trust that they can handle it. Like, that feels like it's so far away that it will never really happen. And while that can't happen, it means that the Bitter Street Witch and you know, the vice principal and maybe the foreman, if they leave the foreman around, like, those three will never be comfortable being council members, except by force, because they don't have the right to govern their own areas, right? I don't know. It's a dynamic that I think the Kennet Council hasn't come to grips with yet. They can't want the Undercity to be an autonomous and self-sustaining part of Kennet while also wanting to enact ownership over it and enact and enforce rules upon it. Those two are kind of mutually exclusive. Anywho, this topic comes up in the Bitter Street Witches conversation, which, you know, Lucy and the Witch go off for a side conversation here. And yeah, I mean, like, this is our first real interaction with the BSW, and she definitely feels like somebody who can be dealt with, right, can be lived with in a way that the family man can't be. Although the downside to that is she doesn't seem, well, it's an interesting one. She doesn't seem especially, like, powerful in a militaristic sense. Her precognitive powers obviously prove very useful later on in this chapter, but she doesn't seem like she has a lot of power to defend her territories, and even she admits that she won't be willing to do any real fighting. She would rather give up her territories and be safe than fight, which is obviously a bit annoying when she's the first person they're really recruiting from the Undercity into the kind of new Kennet Council. But it's probably worth pointing out that if she was more powerful, she would be much less willing to bargain with them. So, you know, you got to take what you can get, I suppose. A great line from Rook here, where she says that she resembles the birds that BSW decapitates, who've seen enough things enough times to be able to see where things are going, but you don't have to bite off Rook's head to get that sort of knowledge. And I think that's just, Rook really has a way with words, which I think is wonderful. The part that's really interesting to me about this segment is the ending, when the family man makes his offer to BSW, and BSW kind of is putting on her charade, and that's fine, but her lieutenants, let's call them, have this moment of lingering and looking behind. And, you know, the family man's offer is, I will give three wives to each of your lieutenants, right? It seems like the family man has made an interesting play here, where he is starting to sow a bit of discord amongst the lieutenants of the BSW, potentially recruiting them, potentially kind of leading towards some kind of mutiny or something. Yeah, I mean, like, it's a good play by the family man. It's a strong play, because the Bitter Street Witch herself talks about how her boys, as she calls them, are not especially clever, which means they're probably ripe for manipulation, the exact kind of cult manipulation that the family man offers. So yeah, that's a bit foreboding. Seems like, yeah, the Bigotry Witch is really in a rough position there. And yeah, the timeline of needing to deal with the family man is creeping up more and more aggressively, I suppose. Yeah, it's a good one. I think it's very clever. It's fun that the family man is not, like, he's a strong antagonist. You hate him, but he is competent. He is doing a lot of very clever things to cement his position, and it makes him a tough one. Yeah, Clawford points out the Bigotry Witch even mentions that her boys might turn on her if they're not fed and entertained. So, you know, we're definitely seeing that starting to take shape for sure. But yeah, so the Bigotry Witch gives them some info on how to capture Marlin and Lucy and the gang go to do this. I really liked Lucy's almost unwillingness to engage with the vagueness of what the Bigotry Witch has said. Like, she was so worried about, and she's so worried about these rabbits on the hill, like she can't accept the vague instruction there. She needs to, you know, she's talking about, oh, are you really sure we should post out a lookout on the hill so they can see the rabbits? And it's just like, it's very classic Lucy of just not being, I guess, treating things in her very specific way that is quite rigid and unwilling to compromise on something that she doesn't feel like she kind of grasps, you know what I mean? Like, she's unwilling to let something just be vague and not try and understand it and not try and comprehend it, which is the exact wrong way to deal with the vague prophecies of somebody like the BSW, which I think is delightful. Maybe this experience of the rabbits on the hill and what that ended up kind of meaning and how that ended up visualizing will help her learn to chillax a little bit around some of those types of things. The other thread that plays through this and the next chapter, which I think we'll talk about a little bit more in a bit, is Lucy's general, like, discomfort with casual murder of these villainous others. There's a bit of murder and brutality in this chapter with the kind of guards of the family man that are here for Marlin. And then next chapter, obviously, the kind of, you know, the people that are being signaled and the lieutenant and stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's just interesting. I think Lucy, there was some conversation about this in the Discord as well that I saw just before the chapter started. Like, Lucy's relationship with violence has been such an interesting and strong thread throughout her character arc in this story. Her initial kind of eagerness to reach for violence and being given the weapon ring by Marcy, and then kind of her reaction to that and intentionally pushing away from that. And now she's been chosen as the, you know, the one that needs to find a new Carmine, and kind of the brutality of the Carmine contest itself really, I think, brought that to the fore, especially with her decision around whether to kill Charles or not. Like, there was just a lot of hectic stuff. A lot of her really needing to re-evaluate her relationship with violence, and I'm interested to see where she lands on it. I mean, like, her decision not to shoot Charles, obviously, indirectly, potentially led to John's death, right? Or not even that indirectly, but it might have, you know, there might have been some tricks there, but I'm sure she feels like her decision not to shoot Charles led to John's death. And now she's kind of setting up Grandfather to be the new Carmine, and she's, you know, trying to avoid him doing any brutal murders, but also, you know, there is obviously death that needs to be done here, and it's just very morally complex. And Lucy is a character who needs to kind of clarify things into black and white. Doesn't gel very well with this morally complex scenario, and I think that's just a fascinating exploration of her, you know, her relationship to violence, seeing where this is going to end up. I don't know. Maybe the answer is that it will never be fully resolved, and she's always going to need to have a bit of discomfort around when, you know, judicial violence can be applied. And maybe that level of discomfort is a good thing, right? Maybe it lets you make sure that you're not crossing the line, or if you need to do something drastic, that you don't do it without careful consideration and you know, corresponding guilt that that something like that should at least somewhat carry. Yeah, it's interesting. As Izzard pulls out or mentions that it's interesting to see how Lucy behaves in isolation from Verona and Avery, which I think is true as well. Lucy is the moral compass of the group very often, right? Or the strongest, let's say the strongest moral compass. And without the group around to need to be the moral compass to, she's still kind of acting in that role to the Kennet Council. But she's less, she seems more introspective about it and less like prescriptive, I guess I would say. I mentioned before that the witch, I didn't think the BSW was especially militaristically powerful, obviously, and neither does she. But these predictions here are very useful. Like, they almost certainly wouldn't have been able to capture Marlin again without her help. In fact, explicitly in the text, there are three or four times when Marlin would have escaped or you know, additional reinforcements would have shown up or all kinds of things like that that are just... It really hammers home almost immediately. Without the Bittersweet Witch, they would have been in real trouble. Yeah, I'm glad that they managed to get her on side because reading this section, the thought of like, hey, if the Bittersweet Witch hadn't volunteered to be so helpful in exchange for, you know, some concessions with them, they really just would not have got Marlin and things would have gone very troublingly. So that's fun. Yeah, I look forward to more vague predictions from the BSW and how they will play out with things like the showdown with the family man. Wabo says in chat, she doesn't have a lot of muscle, but she can point that muscle to the exact right time and place, which is, yeah, exactly it, right? Like, the BSW's lieutenants don't seem especially strong. Nothing about her force seems especially strong, but she just is always in the right place. The twist on that, that her body is becoming increasingly kind of decrepit and playing into that further and further, right? Her body is becoming weaker and weaker as her prediction abilities get stronger. Presumably there will be something similar happening to her lieutenants in the same way. Like they aren't especially smart, presumably as part of the warping around her being the kind of brain for them. It's very interesting how that role is becoming, you know, defined more and more. I feel bad for the witch because she's obviously going down a pretty, you know, decrepit path, which is not especially fun for her, I'm sure. Anyway, this chapter ends with a bunch more refugees showing up, you know, to cause chaos, and that's the setup for the next chapter. And Lucy does very well. Despite knowing that these people don't have to be her problem, despite knowing that it's problems that she doesn't have to deal with, she accepts her responsibility for it because it's, you know, the right thing to do, or the moral thing to do, I suppose. So thumbs up, Lucy. But there's also a segment at the end of this chapter here where she's reflecting on her job of finding a replacement Carmine. And I guess I'm interested to hear what everyone else thinks about this, but this is not a good job for Lucy to have, right? It really feels wrong for Lucy to have the job of picking / molding the next Carmine candidate. Because it's just, I mean, like, it turns her relationship with Grandfather into something that is so messed up. And we're going to explore that next chapter as well. But, like, God, there's so much baggage there. And there's so much, I don't know, there's just so much immediate negative reactions to that. I guess there's not a better alternative, really, is there? If they're giving one job to every person, the way that they've broken it down more or less makes sense. Avery has to be leaning into her strength, seemingly. Verona of figuring out how to kill Charles. Lucy of picking the replacement. I don't know. Maybe Verona could be the one who is picking the replacement and Lucy could be the one who's figuring out how to kill Charles. Although, again, I don't necessarily want Lucy to have to be the person that is planning violence. It's not, I don't know. I guess there's no clear wins. Maybe if I was the Kennedys, I would have swapped Lucy and Verona's roles around. I could see that. But, yeah, that's the thing. So Snowdrop's tiny fan calls out that it slots in with Lucy's roles as part of the trio. She's the big picture director kind of setting the goals for them. And choosing the next Carmine is setting the direction for the region as a whole, which makes a lot of sense. But when you go down to the practical level, it's, I don't know, it just is so clearly fraught with so much problems. And maybe that's the point. Maybe it's a way for Lucy to work through her issues a bit. But I would have swapped Lucy and Verona's roles, I reckon, if I was them. Verona should be the person. Verona could do okay at picking who the next Carmine is. That she'd be all right there. And Lucy could definitely pick out how to do some judicial murder of Charles. She would, as we've kind of touched on, I think she would employ enough reason there to figure out what the right level of violence to enact against Charles is. Verona seems to think that this role suits her because she is more willing to be violent than the other two. But if anything, I think that's potentially a weakness in this scenario. Like, I think the Kennedys want to decide as a collective what level of violence is justified and then enact that, rather than have Verona just go off and do that level of violence anyway and then have Lucy be upset with her afterwards or whatever. Maybe the answer to this is that dividing the roles like this practically makes sense, but the Kenneteers are the best when they work as a group, right? So none of these decisions should be made completely in isolation. I suppose they won't be. I suppose everyone will kind of consult and consider a bit. People in chat are saying, so Clawford in chat is saying, and Jaso said this effectively the same thing, they already know what level of violence they need, which is killing Charles. And I agree with that, but like, Verona, I don't think they can just have Verona do that without the three of them making the decision that they're comfortable with it, right? That feels like a mistake to me. But that also feels like the reason Verona thinks that she's right for this job, because she will carry this out without needing to stop and ponder it too much. And I just think that's, again, it's a difficult situation, but I do think that's a problem, right? Like, Verona is comfortable being the person who has to figure out how to kill Charles because she is already, in her heart, accepted that Charles needs to be killed. But Lucy and Avery need to accept that at some point anyway. So I don't think that's enough of a reason for Verona to be the one who does it, right? Like, because if Lucy and Avery don't accept that, then it's going to cause problems. Anywho, this is the interesting question that this chapter raises, is the jobs that they've allocated to themselves really are things that almost certainly need to be done. They need to happen. And so somebody needs to be responsible for figuring out how they happen, and regardless their problems. This raises another interesting question. I'm Easily Impressed asks, do we need to kill Charles though? And obviously the text so far has said to us, yes. Like, the Carmine positions are lifelong positions. The way to be, you know, the way to be replaced is through death. But there is a question of, are we heading towards a resolution that is different from the one that is being signposted so aggressively by the story, right? I mean, it's a Wild Boar story. They're, almost certainly there's going to be some level of subversion of the way that we think things are going to go, right? I mean, you know, Summer Break was that to such an extent. So maybe there's some other solution that they need to find. And the problem with that is, if there is another solution that might present itself, Verona has already decided that she is going to kill Charles, right? Like, if Lucy was the person who was going to be killing Charles, she would definitely look for other options or figure out if there were other options before making the decision. And I don't know, Verona might be more willing to just do it because she thinks it's what needs to be done. And maybe it is what needs to be done. I don't know. It's a tough situation. I'm glad I don't have to be any of the Kennedys, I guess. The other options, a possible other option that Zizzard and Sengachi raise is like changing what the judgeship looks like, or retiring the position, or reforming the system. Like, yeah, there's a potential different options that might present themselves, especially because Musa is kind of already starting to do something like that anyway. Musa is already trying to change the system, and so there possibly is a way to leverage the fact that Musa is making some grand changes or, you know, presenting an opportunity for changes that, that could be capitalized in a way that the Kenneteers want. We'll have to see. So yeah, let's move into playing a part 1510. So actually, before we do that, I want to pull out this thing that Jay Sir says, because I think it's a very good point, which is, in deciding to kill Charles or kill the family man, they're coming to the realization that your solution cannot always be perfect. They failed on the night of the contest because they were unwilling to be bastards enough, and Charles and co were willing to debase themselves, which I think is an excellent point. The trap of falling into thinking, what's the perfect way we can do this, will detract from possibly a good way of doing it, which is just killing Charles, right? I mean, like, good in the sense that it would get the job done if the fallout from it even is, you know, the guilt and like shame that I'm sure Lucy would feel. Yeah, I don't know. But then again, the other threat to this is setting up systems and changing systems that can be better. So, you know, if you're willing to debase yourself to take the victory there, it's just stepping towards the same system. I don't know. Maybe that's worth it in the end. Maybe it's not. So in 1510, it begins with Lucy reaching out to Timon for a chat, and there's some business relevance to it, but also an interesting personal sentiment, like a tangible feeling of guilt here for Lucy, which is funny, right? Because it's a real catch-22 where Lucy, this is not something that Lucy should have to feel guilty about, except for the fact that she does feel guilty about it, which adds a quirk. The fact that she does feel guilty about it means that there is something there that she should be feeling guilty about, potentially, which I just think is, I don't know, interesting. There's a clear connection in her head between Wallace hasn't replied yet and I'm worried and I'm feeling kind of lonely and isolated, and then let's call Timon, which is just a very, I mean, you know, it's very human. I'm not being critical of Lucy here. It's very human, but it is funny that the fact that she's feeling guilt around it probably implies that there is possibly a seed of something to feel guilty about. So this conversation with Timon, there's a lot that happens in here, but I think that the core insight that Timon gives is to watch the family man to see a bit more of what he's worried about. And obviously castrating him is one that comes up, which would be almost certainly would put a stop to what he's doing. But obviously Lucy's not keen to actually have to carry that out. And that comes back to what we were talking about of, like, that's such an extreme level of violence that would clearly work against the family man if they could carry it out. But Lucy, it would take a lot for Lucy to feel like that's something that could actually, that she would actually feel comfortable doing, and almost certainly would never feel comfortable doing, right? Even if she actually did it wouldn't be a comfortable thing. It's interesting. It's what level of violence do we need to justify? What level of violence can we justify to these actions? And so maybe the solution to the family man is having Verona, who would be potentially more willing to stoop to that level of violence to reflect our progression of, you know, the Carmine drama. Some fun stuff with this conversation with Timon. I did like, we get a bit of an insight into the chaotic vibes of their family. The fact that Timon's cousin just kind of walks around without any pants on is an interesting vibe. But yeah, we then jump forward to Marlon, who is now held captive with Chloe and Nibble. And obviously the star of the show here is Chloe's delight at, you know, playing house, effectively. I loved that. I that was obviously joyful. And we will kind of touch on that a few times, I think. But I found it interesting that Marlon kind of pushes back on Lucy's ideological grandstanding here a bit by saying, "You think you're better than me, little girl? You associate with cannibal undead." And Chloe's response is, "Rude," which it is rude. But it was interesting to me for the fact that, like, Marlon as a practitioner presumably would find this odd, right? Would find, and from what she says, sees Nibble and Chloe just as cannibal undead, but doesn't kind of, I don't know, doesn't click onto the fact that Chloe is playing house and that's a very, like, human thing. It's strange to me that Marlon, I guess, has the opportunity to see that the Kennet others are something more than what she might have expected of them, and kind of doesn't take that opportunity, which I guess is very much like practitioner you know, brainwashing is maybe not the right word, but like conditioning, right? To see others as other with a lowercase o. Yeah, it's just a real missed opportunity, I suppose. And you know, harkens back to things like the Legendres seeing goblins as just one thing and all that stuff. Which is sad, right? I don't know. It's an opportunity to see something that's very cool and different, and Marlin doesn't take it. There's this bit where Bracken comes in and Lucy says, "Hey, Bracken, hi, Doe." And Bracken's reply is, "Yeah." And Lucy bristles a bit at that, which I think is delightful. Lucy and Bracken's relationship is very fun. Their dynamic is really strange. I like that Bracken being so prickly. I wonder if there's an element to it of Lucy seeing, you know, Lucy is somebody who has been described by people, even, I think even non-racist people in this story, as sometimes prickly, which is interesting. Putting her with Bracken here is possibly a way for her to see the effects of this level of prickliness. I don't think she's as bad as Bracken by any means, but maybe it leads to her being a bit warmer with things like the refugees or something like that, where she's trying to be actively more compassionate. Yeah, I wonder. Regardless, Bracken is so frustrating, and Lucy's desire to put in the effort to have a good relationship with him is so heartwarming. Doe brings up the interaction that Lucy and Grandfather had previously, and mentions that Grandfather thought of it as almost like being used, right? Like, Grandfather's first thought with that moment was that she wanted to bind him or kind of use him, which is like not too far off from the truth, actually. Lucy does want to use him, and she says, obviously, I would never want to bind him, and that's true, but, like, him becoming the Carmine would be a binding, would incredibly be binding to him. Yeah, it's obviously something that she would want him to enter into willingly, but she's also kind of manipulating the situation to make him want it and be a good candidate for it. So, yeah, I don't know, I'm definitely, it definitely feels kind of invasive to me. It feels manipulative from Lucy. And it is manipulative, and I think she knows it is, but, like, obviously, again, what options are there, right? Who knows? Yeah, I don't know. It's just, Lucy pushes back on that in this moment, saying, no, of course I would never want to bind him, blah, blah, blah. But, like, I don't think Lucy has fully processed that that is basically what she's doing. Yeah, yeah, it's very complex, isn't it? Snowdrop's Tiny Fan pulls out the point of, like, she is pushing Grandfather towards this dead end that she was desperately pleading with John not to take, and now it feels like they have to have somebody take it. It's, yeah, grim. It's grim, and it's glum. On a lighter note, Bracken has clearly been hanging out with Melissa more, referring to her as just Mel, which is fun. I'm very delighted that Bracken and Melissa are becoming friends. Who knows what that's going to turn into, but the answer is obviously delightful, wherever it goes. That is very fun. Yeah, Bracken and Mel sitting in a tree was definitely, I mean, you know, it's easy to lead into the shipping vibes here because they're both so frustrating in some similar ways. But I don't know if I would want to condemn either of them to that relationship. Maybe it'd be a promising way for them to learn how to be a little bit less frustrating from each other. Anywho, it was very fun to find that out. And then obviously there's the bit about Bracken possibly training with Guillemet. Zikri in chat calls out the train of thought of Lucy learning that Bracken might be good for Bracken to train with Guillemet because he might end up hating the violence that he learns how to dish out, which would be possibly a good change. Again, just some real fun stuff. Some real fun stuff in this section, for sure. Once you put aside all the depressing, you know, Lucy trying to make another John out of Grandfather stuff, it becomes pretty fun. So we head over to the refugee house, and Lucy overhears that there is a signal being sent to some of the family man's family men. So she and grandfather head off to intercept it and get into a pretty brutal fight here. And yeah, I mean, this pulls out more of the Lucy and grandfather stuff with, you know, John's the shadow of John hanging over them. Because I think it's probably true to think that Lucy goes into this fight kind of seeing how grandfather can fit into the shoes of John as a fighter, right? Like, John has had a number of fights like this in the story where he's outnumbered, but he pulls off some really sick military shit, basically, and you know, takes people down and does all this cool stuff. And I think Lucy gives grandfather an opportunity to be like that here. And he's obviously not as developed as John. Like, he gets taken out by the end of this fight, whereas I don't think John would have. But yeah, I mean, like, this is obviously playing on Lucy's mind. And I think she knows that she's doing some concerning stuff here, but still doesn't really know what else to do. And that's pretty tragic. But again, if you just kind of tune all that stuff out, it's a cool fight scene. Grandfather does pretty well. Lucy does pretty well. She has a spear fight with the, you know, family man's number two or high up lieutenant. So thumbs up to that if you put aside all the depressing stuff. Yeah, some cool weapon ring stuff. Some cool, like, you know, Lucy does the old bring up a sword that I can jump off of and use it to kind of take somebody down, which is feels like a very, like, anime special move kind of thing, which I loved. It's delightful. The Fate Arena, yeah, all kinds of cool stuff. So they you know, they rout out the snakes, the rats for the family man. Interestingly, we don't find out exactly what's going to be done to them. I kind of hoped they were going to be sent back, but maybe it's a nope, you know, kill them kind of vibe. Pretty cold-blooded, if so. I think I'm just going to assume that they were sent back to the Undercity. That feels right to me. So yeah, that's fun. So hopefully that's it. They've you know, ratted out the moles, and now it's all just genuine refugees. Who knows? I anticipate that we might see a bit more of the like logistical stress that this is placing on them needing to do. Because at the moment they need to do what? They need to keep an eye on Marlon. They need to be keeping an eye on the refugees. Like, they're clearly being stretched very thin here, right? And it's good that we have, like, Bracken stepping up and stuff like that. But there's a lot to worry about here. They're being pulled in a lot of directions. And, you know, especially while Verona's away, it's, they don't have that many bodies to go around to do all these chores. I'm easily impressed pulls out that there is a very strong chance they get killed by the family man for failure if they're sent back, which is also true. So I don't know what you do with these moles. Maybe, like, just keep them as refugees, but as prisoners more actively. I don't know. As prisoners of war, potentially. Again, not very many clean answers to the problems that are presented to the group in these chapters. But it does end on a somewhat positive note. Lucy calls Verona, and yes, there is tension there, but you can feel it starting to ease a bit by the end of the chapter, and starting to, Lucy gets at least somewhat reassured by the end of the chapter, which is very nice. Very nice. Yeah, the tension between Lucy and Verona has obviously been pretty high since summer break, I guess. And even a bit before then, obviously. And yeah, like, while that is still there, it is nice. It is nice that there is a bit of reaffirmation of trust and love between the two of them by the end of the chapter. It's affirming. It's a balm for the soul. I don't know what they should do. They obviously both have the thought of, like, they can't manage. They just can't handle, right? And they both have the thought of, you know, it would be nice to have Avery around, but that's probably off the table. Maybe the answer is, like, get Nicolette and Zed to come in and hang out a bit more. I mean, I'm sure they have their own stuff going on at the moment, obviously. Maybe there's a way to do that. I don't know. It's troubling. Yeah, Waterfall raises a good point. Awaken Melissa. You know, we have a lot of peripheral Kenneteer, potential Kenneteers, Melissa obviously being a prime candidate. So maybe that's an option. Yeah. God, who knows? They need more help, though, and they just don't have it. So I think that's going to be something that they deal with. They need to figure out where they're going to get that help from. And maybe it's the Undercity. Maybe they can get the Bittersweet Witch and the Vice Principal to be a bit more active in the assistance with some of these problems. It seems like the Bittersweet Witch is potentially comfortable doing that if they are able to make enough concessions. So who knows? A slightly heartwarming but still overall troubling ending to the chapters this week. So does anyone else have thoughts on what people should do? This is we're going to wrap up these solo live episodes here with just a bit of general Q's and A's, I suppose. We're not going to do discussion questions this week or anything like that, just because probably is not enough to manage it. But if anyone has any other thoughts on the chapters or questions or anything like that, feel free to throw them in the live chat and we'll get to them. Ziza did it, brings an interesting point of bringing in Liberty, which again, I mean, Liberty is one of these kind of peripheral Kenneteers, right? Although bringing in Liberty or bringing in like Jude Garrick as an example, that's obviously something that would be done for Avery, which wouldn't directly help with the Kenneteer stuff, although it might mean, you know, Lucy and Verona don't need to take more trips to Thunder Bay as actively, which would give them more space to deal with stuff here, probably. Awaken Jasmine. Yep. Great, great idea. That would be brilliant. No, I mean, like, that's the thing. There's, like, Jeremy and Jasmine and Wallace, who are obviously on the peripheral, but it's a real, like, hamper your long-term happiness for the short-term kind of move to awaken the soul remaining human tethers that Lucy and Verona have. I just think, like, I agree that they would be so helpful, but again, just real, real problematic in the long term. I'm usually impressed, asks an interesting question, which is, I feel like we need to remove the Family Man cult victims from Kennet so they have a chance to recover, but where would we send them? The apartment complex? Yeah, it's an interesting point. I wonder if there's a, I guess the problem is, Kennet so far is the only place that seems like it's somewhat safe to send others to as a place to be, right? Until they can set up more of those kinds of things, there's no support networks for others that can't be in Kennet for whatever reason but need to have somewhere relatively safe to be, like the cult victims of the Family Man. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe as the Kennet vibes take off more, that will be more possible. Taji wants to ask more about my thoughts on the Leos, which is interesting. I'm not sure. I like Taimon. I like their... That's the thing about the Leos, right? Is they seem so nice and friendly, while at the same time, their practice is just incredibly creepy and off-putting and gives you bad vibes, right? Like, they seem nice while at the same time giving you a ton of bad vibes. And it's... I'm put in mind of what Jasmine has said a few times, which is, like, trust your gut on these things. And Snowdrop's Tiny Fan raises that Zed told them to stay away. Zed told the Kenneteers to stay away from them. Like, there's a lot of stuff telling us that we shouldn't see the Leos as friendly. Is it the Leos? It's more the Leoses, I guess. Anyway, so yeah, I'm kind of like, I'm on board with Lucy keeping a bit of distance from them, I guess, just because there's enough strange stuff around them that it probably makes sense to do that. Yeah. The Leosi is the plural. Thank you, Saffron. I guess to wrap up, like, I really loved these two chapters. I really love where Lucy's arc is going, her kind of wrestling more with some of these really tough moral questions that are just not black and white enough for her to be comfortable with them. I think that's very fascinating. And some of the stuff that I love the most about Wild Boar's works is raising complicated moral questions and having the characters examine them. And Lucy's the perfect character to be doing that. So I'm really eager for that. The Family Man seems like a fun and smart and complex villain for them. So that's very fun. It's just it's a good time. It's a good time for the story. A lot of cool stuff going on. I guess we'll be continuing the showdown with the family man in the next few chapters. So if you want to leave your thoughts on this episode, you can do that by going to the discussion thread, which will be linked in the show notes down below. You can head to the Discord, as we mentioned, to participate more in the show, especially in these solo eps. Go to doofmedia.com/discord for that. We are planning a holiday live stream event. We'll be watching some Christmas films. So I think there's more info in the Discord on that. I'm not sure where that is. We'll probably talk about it in the general channel pretty soon. But if you want to support the shows on the Doof Media Network, you can go to patreon.com/doofmedia and become a patron. You get all kinds of perks like bonus shows and all that jazz. Or if you want to support Wildbo, go to patreon.com/Wildbo. And you can support him there. Thanks for joining, everyone. Thanks for hanging out in this solo ep. Different vibes, but hopefully still enjoyable vibes. And yeah, catch you around next time, I suppose.